Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to continue with our exploration of the development of the SS and the camp system in Germany during the 1930s. And today we're going to look at the Totenkopf SS, the Death's Head, perhaps the most notorious branch of the SS and one that most listeners will be familiar with. Now, if you study Nazi Germany in school, the SS emerge as significant characters in the kind of the narrative of, say, in the UK GCSE history study. When you look at the Night of the Long Knives, all of a sudden they're there. Prior to that, mainly the focus is on the SA, and then the SS are a force, and they are the people that kill the leadership of the SA, and that's kind of as much as they're mentioned before one goes on to study the Holocaust. But of course the development and the growth of the SS is a much more complicated story. So here we look at Nicholas Rushton again, and he writes, "The Death's Head SS expanded fast during the second half of the 1930s, growing from 1,987 men in January 1935 to 5,371 in January 1938. In each KL, each camp, these men were divided into two main groups. A select few, easily identified by the letter K on their uniforms, joined the so-called commandant's staff and controlled most key aspects of the camps, including the prisoner compound itself. The rest belonged to the so-called guard troop sentries, with one Death's Head battalion, later regiment, stationed at every concentration camp for men. The guard troops were responsible for external security. They patrolled the camp perimeter and manned the watchtowers and shot prisoners who crossed the sentry line. They also guarded prisoners working outside, offering them the opportunity for hands-on violence. Although there were many points of contact between the guard troops and the commandant staff, the SS tried to maintain a division of duties. Normally, sentries were not even permitted inside the camp compound. This separation between running a camp and guarding it, a separation already in place at camps like Dachau, became the basic organisational feature of the KL." So that's interesting, that there is this subdivision between K staff and guard staff, and that there were strict rules and boundaries as to where people could go. If you listen to the previous podcast on the camps and the SS, as I did, I think probably last week sometime, what becomes clear is that the violence of the SS in the camps had to be strictly managed and directed. It's not that the camp leadership were averse to violence, they were averse to disorder. So, most of the camp SS men were sentries in the guard troop, and these would outnumber the commandant staff by a ratio of about 12 to 1 by 1937. So the K staff were really a minority, and so these were really treasured and sought after posts within the SS. The sentries went through a selection process, and this meant that they, the image of the SS and the kind of the myth of the SS was that they were the elite. So even the rank and file, unlike the SA, had to be carefully selected. All recruits obviously had to be physically healthy, were at least 5'6", and they had to articulate physically the ideals of Aryan manhood, of masculinity and manliness, and physical fitness, and they had to be able to trace back their Aryan heritage to the 18th century. There was a roaring trade in Germany of genealogists who were able to investigate the family history and investigate racial purity going back many generations. Of course, these things were haphazard, and these things could be gerrymandered and invented, with the possibility of Jewish heritage sometimes being erased, or the possibility of some other kind of non-Aryan aspect to family life being kind of erased from the family tree. The head of the camp system, Theodor Eich, who was Himmler's chief sadist in the SS, was involved in planning the recruitment strategy for the guard troop. And he was quite keen on recruiting them young. There were 16-year-olds that he recruited, and that age group between 16 and 20 was ideal for his purposes. After 20, he started to think that the guard troop was getting too old. Obviously, this is unlikely to be that they were too physically old. I mean, it was probably that they were slightly more, becoming in their 20s, slightly more difficult to mould, to indoctrinate, to shape. And Nicholas Waschmann writes, "The boys, as Himmler called them, were thought to be easily malleable into political soldiers. A more pragmatic motive, given the tight purse strings of the SS, was that single young men came cheap. Eich's obsession with youth changed the camp SS, with the average age dropping to around 20 by 1938. Many new recruits had enrolled straight out of the Hitler Youth, but Eich did not welcome all applicants. They were supposed to show passion for their chosen path and be eager to devote their lives to the SS. Here Eich was drawing on the ideal of the volunteer soldier, a figure long associated in national circles with dedication and self-sacrifice." So, ironically, the SS, which later becomes the bastion of careerism and a place that many careers in the Third Reich grew from, Eich himself didn't really want careerists. He wanted fanatics. He wanted those who were passionate simply about the cause of Nazism in itself, the cause of racial purity. How many of these he found was actually questionable, as he found that the demand for new recruits was far outpaced the number of suitable recruits based on those criteria who were actually available. Somehow, however, Eich managed to achieve his goal, perhaps by dropping standards, or his own particularly perverse racial standards. And by the late 30s, most of the camp SS were made up of teenagers, and most of the camp SS were volunteers. The Death's Head had attracted lots of teenage boys and young men with the idea that it was an elite military unit. Now, the fighting wing of the SS, the Waffen-SS, during the Second World War, that becomes one of the elite arms of the German military. That might be true of them. But the mythology of the Death's Head SS actually far outweighed any kind of military prowess that they might have had. Recruitment material painted or created a kind of a false parallel between the Death's Head and the army. And it implied that the recruits would be carrying out special secret missions for the Führer, which kind of allows in the minds of young German boys the kind of fantasy of playing at soldiers. The reality was that these things didn't really happen in the life of SS men. They were if they were in their death head, they were camp guards and later participants in war crimes and in the Holocaust, which perhaps was, when we're talking about secret missions for the Führer, that might have been actually what really was being implied. The camp side of the this advertising was never mentioned, perhaps because the idea of being a camp guard is less attractive, perhaps because there were, even for recruits into the SS, moral questions that would have to be raised about camp guard duties, and moral questions which fly out of the window once one's actually doing the job and being indoctrinated by people like Theodor Eich, but moral questions nonetheless. So these things are brushed under the carpet. Most applicants would probably have had an idea where they were going to be stationed, but the camp duty isn't really seen as a particular selling point. So I imagine that in the minds of, there's a kind of a cognitive dissonance in the minds of people joining the Death's Head, knowing that really they probably were going to be camp guards, but allowing themselves to indulge in the fantasy of being secret agents or commandos for the Führer. The training of recruits, which involved parades and marches, obstacle courses and weapons exercises, was hard. It was difficult. Newcomers were beasted by the older SS men. They had the process that most armies go through of breaking civilians down and then rebuilding them in the model of what the organisation requires. And the organisation here requires not so much military discipline, but the ability to be sadistic and violent.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many of the SS men, the older officers, were veterans of the First World War, and they unleashed their frustrations and their resentments and their bitterness and their anger and their sadism on new recruits. They drilled us, one SS man, a man later recalled, till we howled with rage. The deliberate kind of brutalisation of the SS recruits was a way of storing up in them a violence that which could then be unleashed upon the people that they that they controlled. There was a way of weeding out the weak men, those who would be unwilling or unable to carry out acts of sadism, and there were those who would break down, who would have physical or emotional collapses. And they had were kind of got rid of after 3 months of probationary service. There were those who actually took to the military brutality and saw it as an opportunity to demonstrate their toughness. Those were the ones who were favoured and seen as being ideal for the future. Recruits taken into the guard troop would have a rotation of military drill and a week of sentry duty each month, which was obviously far more tedious and time-consuming and boring than anything that they felt they'd sign up for. The men lived in communal barracks, which were highly regimented, and some felt themselves to be rather like prisoners themselves, but with rifles and uniforms. There was a great envy of other units, such as the Waffen-SS formations, like the Liebstandarte Adolf Hitler, who were better equipped and better paid, who were had higher prestige, and who generally were everything that they the Death's Head recruits thought they'd signed up to be. The Death's Head men were often in the guard troop were often mocked as being the kind of the sentries and the watchmen, while the Liebstandarte and Das Reich and other Waffen-SS divisions got to do the exciting stuff. Morale was not particularly high amongst the Death's Head, and the difference between the heroic self-image and the mundanity of camp life was difficult to bridge. Eich said, "I'm aware of your hardships and I'm striving every day to remove them, but this can only be done one step at a time." It's possible that a perceived lack of prestige had a part to play in sadism and violence. Obviously, this is caused by innumerable things and by the entire nature of the camp and the training and all the rest. But the desire to demonstrate, to overcompensate and to show adherence to the will of the Führer and to be shown to be of equal standing with the Waffen-SS encouraged ever greater displays of violence towards prisoners. There were many of the men from the guard troop who trusted Eich and believed him. He was, to them, quite a charismatic figure, quite a leader, almost a kind of a paternal figure. And they believed that one day that there would be, in career terms, and here it's interesting, we sort of start to shift back towards kind of careerist thinking, because there wasn't enough within the role to sustain a kind of voluntarism, that there would be rich rewards as a result. The Camp SS did offer advancement towards better work and more prestigious work. And there were few of the places in the SS that careers could develop quite as quickly, especially if one's education was fairly minor. There were innumerable figures rising through the Camp SS who were not particularly bright in it by any stretch of the imagination. There were those interviewed after the war, people like, for example, Franz Stangl, who was interviewed by Gita Sereni. Gita Sereni found him. He was the commandant of Treblinka, and Gita Sereni eventually found him not to be a particularly kind of a demonic sort of figure, but a rather dull and banal and a trivial little man, I think she referred to him as. And no doubt that there were a number of figures like that. So it was possible to become an officer in just a couple of years. And the commandant's staff were full of men who had started off in the guard staff and begun to move over. And the superiors, in the eyes of their superiors, these were people who had proven themselves, firstly as political idealists or politically loyal, and now those who were able to be kind of more managerial. And of course, one of the most significant of these figures would later be the person who would later become commandant of Auschwitz, Rudolf Höss. Now, if you go way back to the archives, it must have been 2 years ago now at least, I talked about the memoirs of Rudolf Höss and his kind of last testimony before he was executed. His story tells us quite a lot about Nazism. He was born in 1900, and served in the First World War as a teenager and served in the Freikorps immediately afterwards. It was men like Rudolf Höss who had engaged in some of the Freikorps' bloody battles, not just in Germany but in the Baltic states, against the new Bolshevik regime. He was obsessed with violence, and yet was a very kind of emotionally brittle individual. And was convicted for murder in 1924, killing after having killed a communist. And throughout his story, his biography is documented very well by Richard J. Evans in the Coming of the Third Reich, and it's dotted with kind of periods of dark depression and emotional instability. And there seems to be some kind of journey for kind of completion and identity and belonging. Not that I'm being sympathetic and trying to psychoanalyze mass murderers here, but those motivations do tell a story. During the 1920s, Höss had forged all these connections with extreme right-wing groups in the Freikorps, and all that, and it was these that eventually brought him to the SS camp system. He joined the Nazis in the early 20s, and that's when he'd met Himmler. And in 1934, when Himmler was inspecting the SS, Höss had joined in 1933. Himmler suggested to him that he'd join the Death's Head in the SS camp system. Höss accepted, and he was tempted, really, by the careerist opportunities that were there. And when he joined Dachau as a sentry, 4 months later, I chose him from the guard troop to move from the guard troop to the commandant staff in this manner that we've been talking about in the podcast. And that really was his journey, not just from Dachau, but eventually to Poland once in 1939 and to running the new institution of Auschwitz. Höss's career would probably be more meteoric than anybody else's in any other recruit-level person in the SS. But his story, his background, was quite similar to many other on the commandant staff. They were largely in their 20s and 30s. They were older than the young boys in the guard troop, and most of them had previously had some kind of military background, either in the First World War or in the fighting for the party in the 1920s, or in the Freikorps, some kind of military or paramilitary role. And they had been early adopters of Nazism. And in the spring of 1934, 8 of the 11 officers in the Dachau Commandant staff had very low SS membership numbers, under 10,000. So that showed that they were in the first generation of men to have joined the SS. They weren't these kind of late adopters. Okay, so we're going to carry on more with that probably next week sometime now. But I hope you found that useful and interesting. If you can support us via Patreon, that's very, very helpful. Gratefully received. And I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.